Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to the Chats That Matter podcast, the only podcast exclusively for employees of Cincinnati Bell, Inc. That's CBTS, Onyx, Hawaiian Telecom, and of course, Cincinnati Bell. We recently celebrated Hispanic Heritage Month, marking several weeks of cultural exchange and exploration. And we were fortunate to round out October with a visit from a very special guest, Anthony Munoz. For those of you who don't know, Anthony Munoz is a former American football offensive tackle who played 13 seasons with the Cincinnati Bengals. One of the greatest offensive linemen in NFL history, Munoz was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1998. On the podcast today, Anthony joins Conexion Chair Dan Colonhe and myself to talk about his experience growing up to become an influential community leader and a role model for Hispanic youth across the country. So without further ado, let's settle in and take a listen.
Well, Anthony Munoz, thank you so much for being here today.
And thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
It's been about a year now that we've had this Hispanic Employee Resource Group here called Conexion, and this is our first year actually celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month, which runs from September 15th to October 15th. And we couldn't think of a better guest to have here to help us celebrate than you. So we really appreciate you being here.
I'm excited that I get a chance to be here during Hispanic Heritage Month because several years ago when I first got to Cincinnati, my hair was down to my shoulders, and a lot of people didn't know that I was Hispanic. They thought I was Samoan or somewhere from the islands. So it's good that people know that Munoz is a Hispanic.
Exactly. Yeah, that's great. You know, you're obviously a very accomplished football player, you're in the Hall of Fame. You're also a very accomplished philanthropist as well with your foundation. But before all that, can we go back to more of your origin story? You know, sort of what was it like, you know, growing up for you?
Yeah, I think that's great. You know, a lot of times people focus on the body of work, the NFL career or the, you know, the foundation. And I always believe that it's good to really talk about the journey. I really encourage a lot of people not to forget where they come from and appreciate where you come from. You know, I grew up in Ontario, California, which was about 40 miles east of L.A., and I'm always sure to say California because when I say I'm from Ontario, people look at me and say, you're Canadian? But Ontario, California, 40 miles east of L.A., mom raising five kids by herself. My mom, Esther, raised myself and two older brothers and two younger sisters by herself, working two, three jobs. I mean, not just any two or three jobs. I mean, they were hard labor jobs. My dad never met my dad. My dad was in and out of prison when I was growing up. I heard indirectly that he had passed away at a halfway house, so I never had the chance to meet him. I know a little bit about him, but not a whole lot. But getting back to mom, amazing lady. When I talk about jobs, I'm talking about where I grew up, there was orange orchards and grape vineyards. So she used to go out in the vineyards and pick grapes. And the good thing about it, she'd bring home some pretty good juicy grapes. But that was one of her jobs that she, of course, that was seasonal. Another one, she worked at a chicken ranch packing eggs. It wasn't a benefit to me because I never liked eggs, never will like eggs. So for my siblings, they liked eggs. But it provided some jobs during the high school. I would go in, they had to vaccinate the chickens. So I would help with that for the weekend and get some have some spending money, which we never really had a whole lot of. And then there was times where myself or my siblings would walk home from school with pillowcases full of clothes. She would iron clothes for our teachers for money. I would put her ironing up with any dry cleaner. With all due respect to dry cleaners and the great job they do, mom did a phenomenal job ironing clothes. So, and we didn't have a whole lot. I mean, never had a car. She's one of us. She was one of 11, so we had aunts and uncles that really supported us. A lot of it was, by foot, wherever we had to get to or rides from our relatives. But that didn't matter to her. She provided for her five kids. I'll never forget her saying, you don't have to be rich to look clean. You know, I talk about her ironing and her washing clothes. We might have like one pair of pants for the school year, but man, they were always washed and ironed. And when I talk iron, I mean starched and creased and, you'd have to kind of, move them around to loosen them up a little bit. And I'd always say, Mom, why do you have to iron our undershirts? Nobody sees them. She goes, I see them. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't trade that for anything because we learned some valuable lessons from her. All you had to do was watch her. Leave 6 in the morning, walk into work, come back 5, 5:30, fix dinner. We learned work ethic, what it mean to work extremely hard. We learned responsibility because during the summer, in order to go out, and baseball is my first love, to play baseball, we had to do our chores at home. I mean, we had to clean the house, make sure everything was done before she got home. We'd do that early on and then go. So we learned how to clean house. We learned how to wash clothes, wash dishes. We learned how to cook. I mean, so, you know, because she was gone during the day, so we very valuable lessons. So I thank her a lot for teaching us. And again, she didn't sit there and say, okay, this just by example, she taught us what it meant to work hard and how to bust her tail. Because we knew, like I said, hard labor jobs that she was working to provide for her five kids.
Wow.
That's really amazing. Humbling.
Yeah. What are some stories about your Hispanic roots? Do you have, is there anything there that you want to share?
Yeah, quite a bit. In fact, it's been exciting as an adult to really, really learn and know about my grandparents and great-grandparents, who I grew up knowing because they were born and raised in Chihuahua, Mexico, and came to the States in the early 1900s, and I got to know them. I mean, we spent a lot of time with them. Not as much with my great-grandfather because he passed away when I was really, really young. Of course, now I'm talking my mom's side of the family because I never knew my dad's side of the family. Yeah. So my grandfather Angel and my grandmother Juana, you know, they're my mom's parents and then, you know, her parents. So I'll never forget my grandfather, who was 6'5", my mom's dad, passed when I was like 6 years old. So I got to know him a little bit, big man. I'll never forget the one thing we knew as grandkids is Sunday afternoon, you didn't trampled through the front room because somehow he was able to receive the bullfights from Mexico, and that was his big thing, watching bullfights. So we kept the room quiet when he was watching, but what a great man. Then my grandma, my mom's mom, passed when I was a senior in high school, right after a high school football game. You know, so the culture was brought to us as kids. I mean, not only the food, but the parties. They made sure that we were familiar with them. So I grew up with that. So it was one of those things where the music, I mean, you know, the mariachis and all the music and the foods, I really appreciate it, you know, because growing up with that, it became a staple of, you know, what we ate and what we got used to. So, yeah, I appreciate that from my mom and her parents. And, I tell people she was one of 11. And when we had family reunions about 20 years ago, we had really our last big family reunion. We rented a park, and there was about 300 people, immediate family.
Really?
And at that That's time, amazing. We had like a half dozen picnic tables slid together, and it was all home-cooked meals. I mean, it
that
was
sounds
I think the kids were like, well, they had to be like teenagers, and my son and I sat there and ate all day. And we did take a little time to walk around the park, but I mean, you know, it was just amazing food. And so when you talk about the Hispanic culture, there was no lack of it growing up as a kid.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's really cool. And you kept in touch with that throughout your childhood and into your college. Speaking of college, you ended up going to USC. You want to talk a little about that transition for you? How was that?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things growing up there, just right down the street from the campus. I fell in love with the university. Never in my wildest dreams, first of all, that would I think I'd have the opportunity to go there. Financially, you know, there's just no way. But through athletics and school, I was able to receive a scholarship to go to USC, which was huge because at a very young age, probably 12, 13, I fell in love with the university. And when they started knocking on my door and recruiting me to come to school and play football, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this is like a dream, winning the lottery. And I basically told everybody else around the country, no thank you. Because at that time, by my junior year, every university was knocking at my door and asking me to come to school and play football. And I was like, thank you, but no thank you. I'm pretty well set on where I'm going to go, stay in Southern California. So I decided to go to USC. And back when I was coming out of high school in 1976, USC was, you know, winning national championships, winning Rose Bowls. Heisman Trophy winners were being pumped out, All-Americans, first-round draft picks. And as a, you know, 17-year-old senior in high school, I said, you know, I want some of that. I want to be one of those guys.
Yeah, right.
So I went to USC with big plans. And again, kind of similar to growing up with not a whole lot. I got to USC and my plans didn't go the way that I thought they were going to go. School was fine. I mean, I finished school, I went through school, but athletically, it was tough. Really my first adversity in athletics, because in high school, I played football, basketball, and baseball for 4 years, and I can't remember missing a game just going from one sport to the next every year. Well, now at USC, I experienced some physical adversity. In the 4 years at USC, I had three major knee operations. I played one healthy season at USC. My freshman year, seven games in the season, my first knee operation. My sophomore year, I was healthy, played the entire season. My junior year, seven games in the season, another knee operation. In those two of those first 3 years, we went to the Rose Bowl. So I didn't play in the Rose Bowl. I didn't play in the UCLA game. I didn't play in Notre Dame game. I'm sitting there basically rooting on the guys that I was practicing with during camp, but not playing the season. So my senior year, after going through my second knee operation my junior year, this time it was the first game of my senior year. This time it was my left knee. Going through my third knee operation in 4 years, I missed the entire season. So, you know, at the time when you're going through this, it's tough. It's difficult because the guys you want to be playing with are out there playing, and you're just like rehabilitating the whole time. But, you know, when I look back, again, when I talk about the values my mom taught us, those kicked in college. I mean, the work ethic, the never give up attitude, the responsibility. I knew the responsibility of going to school, the work ethic of rehabilitating, the responsibility of all that, and never give up. I mean, and I did that even my senior year where, you know, it was my third knee operation. My schedule was I go to class, go to rehab, you know, strength training, and then go back to my apartment, do some homework, and that was it. But I was determined to play one more time. And we won our conference again, and we went to our third Rose Bowl in 4 years. And because of the lessons I learned from family members, coaches, and teachers, I got myself back, and the coach, I had to convince him. The doctor okayed me. The coach allowed me to go back out and start practice. I went through every practice, and I played in the Rose Bowl, the only Rose Bowl, the only game my senior year in college. And as I look back, little did I know that that would lead to, you know, being drafted by the Bengals and playing 13 years. But I have no regrets of what I went through in college in that adversity, because I really believe it taught me a lot about life, taught me a lot about myself, and how you never give up and you just keep moving forward.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You talk about values and how somebody can get those values as a child growing up. You have your parents really teach you so much, you know, and it's seeing them, you know, work hard, seeing them go through that, and then being like, you know, that's how you do it, you know. And then when it comes to your turn, then you know that's how mom and dad did it. And that's how I'm going to do it.
I agree with you. And a lot of times, you know, I think people get caught up in the verbalization of things and really verbalizing. And what I learned, it's more living it out. I mean, you know, your mom or dad can tell you something, but if they're not doing what they're talking about, then what good is it? So mom didn't have to say a whole lot. She just did it. She lived it out. And we saw how it worked. So when you're going through that adversity, you know, you think back to those times where we would meet her outside, where she would walk along the railroad tracks to get back home after work. And we'd kind of, you know, for me, I'd kind of see, you know, how many of those grapes did you bring that I can start eating before you make dinner? You know, so it was one of those things where you watch, and you watch closely about, you know, how people are living their lives. And it was obvious that, you know, work ethic, responsibility. I mean, she had five kids. That was her responsibility, you know, and she took it seriously. And not only providing for us, but at athletic events. She was Mama Bear, man. She don't criticize or get after her kids, because you could. I said, Mom, okay, kind of. I was playing a game and I'd hear her. But so you watch closely and you learn from that.
That's great. I mean, follow along that. I mean, you mentioned being drafted by the Bengals. That must have been the first time you haven't heard of the word Cincinnati. Like, what? Cincinnati? Who? You know, what? Yeah.
Was Wait, it? You mean Cincinnati's not Southern California? Like,
yeah. Right. It's funny you mention that. So, first of all, I mentioned just playing one game my senior year. So I didn't really know if I was going to get a chance to go to an NFL team. So at that time, I felt really good about things physically. I just wanted a chance to go to an NFL camp to see if I could compete on that level. Mm-hmm. Because at USC, I mean, you're competing against the best of the best. And then you're playing teams where, well, I didn't play against many teams, but I practiced a lot against my guys. And, you know, my freshman year at SC, we had three of the first five picks in the NFL draft. You know, so we had my senior year, the year I missed the entire year, from the starting 22, we had, I think, 15 number one picks in the NFL. Wow, we have four Pro Football Hall of Famers off that team that I missed the entire season.
Is that right?
So it was one of those things where just give me a chance. And, of course, the Bengals had the number three pick in the draft, and they called me and said they had drafted me. So you got to imagine the emotion of, first of all, being the number three pick in the entire draft and only playing one game your senior year, then turning to my wife. We got married my sophomore year in college. So we're in our one-bedroom apartment. And I said, I hung up the phone. I said, Didi, we're going to Cincinnati. And she knew where they were picked. Mm-hmm. But the first thing she says is, where's Cincinnati?
Right, exactly.
Well, I didn't know because I'm not a geography guy, but I knew one thing. I knew that the stadium that we would be playing in was right on the river.
Yeah.
Because like I mentioned earlier, baseball was my first love. I watched a lot of games of the Big Red Machine
in
Riverfront Stadium on the river. So I knew I was going back and hopefully meet a lot of those guys, but play in that stadium. So we had to pull out a map and say, okay, there it is. And then we get back here and they call it the Midwest. I'm thinking, I still say it's two states from the East Coast. Right. Why is it considered the Midwest? But we were thrilled, to say the least. I mean, thrilled and to be coming to Cincinnati and get a chance to play in the NFL.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I imagine adjusting to life here must have been, I just couldn't imagine being from Southern California and used to not the weather and even, but just to the whole environment, the culture, and then coming here, very different for you, I bet.
Very different. I mean, growing up my entire life in Southern California, coming back here, my wife and I, for the first time, she basically, for most of her life, after her dad retired from the Army, they settled in Southern California. She was a young age. So we come back here and it was different. I mean, not to mention the weather, but just the culture. I'm glad that we could fly my mom back every so often because now I'm 61. I've yet, and again, all due respect to Mexican restaurants and those that make flour tortillas, I have not eaten any flour tortillas like my mom has made. She would pump them out, big stacks, and it looked like she cut them out because they were perfectly round. She had this big rolling pin that she, and so that was the first thing. I mean, like I said, I'm thankful we could bring her out because then she could make us some tortillas here in Cincinnati. Another thing, which I still kind of laugh, one of the first interviews I did when I got back here, I mentioned to the reporter, I said, I don't mind it. We're kind of making the adjustment. I said, but I can't find any good salsa back here. It's like, I love salsa. And so it was like, after that article came out, every restaurant that my wife and I would go to, it could be a steakhouse, it would be a Japanese steak, the cook would come out with salsa that he and I would eat it and just kind of smile and say, good.
Yeah, exactly.
But, other than that, I mean, it was, not a whole lot of people look like I did, growing up in Southern California is very diverse. So that really, I mean, I was used to that because, growing up, some of my best friends were Caucasian, African-American. We'd go to each other's home and we learned about each other. So coming back here was just a new opportunity to learn a new culture. But it was different. It was really different. I mean, for the first time during my rookie year, I experienced going out and have to practice and play in snow, something that I saw on TV, in movies.
Right.
Which I enjoyed. I mean, the first time I got to my locker and they had thermal underwears in our locker, I'm thinking, what are these for? Then I went outside to practice. I said, okay, I need some thermal underwears. It's a little chilly out there. But there's a lot of different things that we had to get used to, but it didn't take long to get used to it.
Yeah.
I mean, the city embraced us. We embraced the city. We embraced the difference in culture. And, I kind of always use sports analogies. As a former offensive lineman, you had to audibleize a lot as an offense. And you just audibleize. And, hey, this isn't what it used to be. So you change and you do this. So, and we love challenges. And it was challenged. And it's been fun for us.
That's great. That's great. Well, I know we're going to have a lot of Bengals fans listening to this here today.
This might be our highest rated podcast.
That's right. Oh, wow. That's right. So we'd be remiss without talking about, the Bengals and kind of what your experience was like over those years that you played such a high level. What were some of the most memorable experiences for you during that time?
I had a lot of great experiences, especially now living in Cincinnati after playing my entire career here. There are quite a few guys that I played with that still make Cincinnati home. Just off the top of my head, I think there's close to a dozen guys that were from LA. I'm talking inner city and just outside that still live here that I played with, Northern California, Texas, Florida. So the relationships are the main thing, that guys are still here that I played with. And it's not like we're here and we don't see each other. We see each other. We're involved with each other. They support my foundation. I support theirs. We support a lot of events in the community. So we see each other quite a bit. So it had some great memories. My first year was tough. I mean, they had just come off two back-to-back 4-12 seasons. So my rookie year, they hired a new head coach, Forrest Gregg, who played for those great Green Bay Packers teams, Vince Lombardi. For those football fans, know Vince Lombardi is one of the greatest head coaches ever.
Yeah.
The Green Bay Packers, I mean, with Bart Starr and Paul Hornung and, you know, Forrest Gregg and, I mean, Ray Nitschke, and just go on. And to have a coach that Vince Lombardi, in his last book that he wrote, he said Forrest Gregg was the finest player that I ever coached. And here I am. I'm offensive tackle. He's a Hall of Fame tackle, and he's my head coach. So I get here, and even though, like I said, we were 4-12 2 years in a row, I could see the transformation with the new coaching staff. A lot of the same players that were here, he had a lot of top draft picks that were here that he started to really transform and get them ready to play on this level, to get them in shape, to get the confidence. My rookie year, we go 6-10, but we could have very easily been 10-6. We lost some games late in the game. And when you get in the NFL, you want to get in the playoffs and go to a Super Bowl. I mean, that's what you want to do. That's your first and foremost goal that you want to do. And my second year, we win the conference. We have all the playoff games here. We had home field advantage. We win the AFC championship game here. And we're going to a Super Bowl my second year with the new staff, with a lot of new players. So early on, the experiences were great, going to a Super Bowl. So I'm thinking, this is my second year. Yeah, I'm used to winning like I did at USC. We're going to go to a few Super Bowls.
Right.
But even though we didn't go to another one until 10 years later, we had some great seasons. We had some great players. You know, so the guys I played with when I first got here, Kenny Anderson, you know, late in his career, he kind of reignited him. He became the MVP that Super Bowl year. You know, guys like Pete Johnson, Archie Griffin, Isaac Curtis, and then we had some young guys like Chris Collinsworth, and played with some great linemen, Max Montoya, and, you know, Dave Lapham, who's now the voice of the Bengals forever. He was a guy I played next to my first 4 years. He was a left guard. I was a left tackle. So, you know, a lot of great memories, you know, the relationships, the coaches. I was fortunate. Before they drafted me, they hired an offensive line coach from the college ranks, Jim McNally. He ended up being here for 15 years. I played all 13 of my years for Jim McNally, which is rare as an NFL football player. On the other hand, one of my best friends from college was a number one pick offensive lineman for the Kansas City Chiefs. For his 9 years with the Chiefs, I think he had 5 offensive line coaches.
Wow.
So I was fortunate to have, you know, we changed head coaches. I played for, you know, three head coaches, but my offensive line coach was the same. The guys I played with are still here in town. Some great memories. We had some great games. I mean, I talked about that Super Bowl. You talk about memories. Talk about that Super Bowl my second year that we went to Pontiac to play the 49ers. The AFC Championship game played right here at the old stadium, Riverfront Stadium. Coldest game on record. I mean, with the temperature and the wind chill, it was 59 below.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, wait, I'm just from California, 2 years removed. That one game I played, that Rose Bowl at USC, my last game, January 1st, 1980, it was 83 degrees.
Right.
Now I'm playing mid-December, 59 below. So that's a memory. And, you know, we win that game, and, you know, people say, how'd you play in that game? I said, well, we were going to play and play our best because it was to get to the Super Bowl, you know, and both teams had to play in that weather. But, you know, the San Diego Chargers coming from San Diego, the week before they'd played and beat Miami in like 100 degrees with 100, you know, percent humidity. Yep. And then they come here and it's a little chilly. And so that's, a great memory. And the two Super Bowls are great memories. So the guys at Kenny Anderson, one of the quarterbacks, Boomer Esiason, the other quarterback, being around Paul Brown for 10 years. I mean, he had already retired from coaching, but he was there every single day. The guy that brought so much to the game, coach of the Browns, coach of, you know, the Bengals. He started the Bengals. And every meeting, every road trip, he was there. He knew exactly what was going on. Every Monday morning, he would meet with the coaches, and he would be at every practice. So we got to know him extremely well.
That's amazing.
And every time we were around him, it was like a history lesson, you know. Before games, we'd always get to the stadium in the locker room early. We'd be laying around, and he'd come in and ask us questions. And we knew he knew all the answers to the questions. But then it would lead to a story, and he would tell us stories either of his days at, you know, Maslin High School up in Northeast Ohio, or his days in Ohio State, or with the Cleveland Browns, or with the Bengals. And just to think about all the championships, not Super Bowls, but all the championships he won as a head coach, high school, college, and with the Cleveland Browns. It's amazing. And the guys he coached. I got to meet a lot of the guys he coached, like Otto Graham and Dante Lavelli and, you know, those type of guys. Bill Willis, who he coached in college, and, you know, one of the first African-Americans, and just a great guy. Got to meet a lot of those guys that he coached. So not only did I spend time around him as an owner, but then I had a connection with guys that played for him. So there's a great memories that I had in my 13 years with the Bengals.
That's great. Now, I cannot imagine playing two Super Bowls
in two totally different places. You know, we're in Pontiac, Michigan after that Freezer Bowl, and the weather was terrible up there for the whole week. We're up there, we couldn't go outside because it was so cold. And then 10 years later, Super Bowl 23, we're in Miami, Florida. You know, it's like 85 degrees, and right. you're sweating, and you know, you're outside. And we get there a couple days early, so we had a chance to go out and do a little fishing and play a little golf before we resumed our preparation. So two totally different environments, but they were Super Bowls. And I'm thankful that I had those opportunities.
You know, during your time in the NFL, I'm sure it's probably the same time you had your family as well that was growing.
Yeah, exactly. So my wife and I were married my sophomore year in college. So we had spent 2.5 years at USC married. Then we got here. And then Michael, our oldest, he was born actually a Super Bowl year. He was born before the season, my second year. So, he was 1981, 81 season, 82 Super Bowl. He's the oldest. He just turned 38. And then Michelle, our daughter, was born in 83. So she's 19 months younger than Michael. They're both pretty good athletes. Michael was an offensive lineman coming out of high school. He played at Moeller, went to school and played at Moeller. He was a number one ranked lineman coming out, could have gone anywhere. He decided to go to the University of Tennessee. He got his undergrad there, was a four-year starter there. Our daughter was a pretty good basketball player. We would never get in shooting contests with her because she'd embarrass us. But she started playing basketball at 10 years old, ended up committing really, before Michael decided to go to Tennessee. She committed to Tennessee after her sophomore year in high school. She became a big Tennessee Vol fan, and we would take her to Pat Summitt's camp every summer from like sixth grade on. And when she was right after her freshman year, she was at the camp, and we're getting ready to drive home. Pat said, "Mish, I'd like to talk to you and your parents." So she said, "We can't do anything legally, but in 2 years, if you want to be a Lady Vol, you have a scholarship." We can't sign anything. So Michelle, we drove home, and drive from Knoxville to Cincinnati. We get home and we're talking about it. She said, "I'm going to call Pat and tell her I'm committing. I'll be there in 2 years." So the good thing was they were there for 1 year. Michael was a sophomore. Michelle was a freshman, both at Tennessee. But then after her freshman year, she transferred and came back to Ohio, went to Ohio State. So she finished up there 3 years, got her undergrad, played 3 years there at Ohio State. And then after that, they started families themselves. Michelle has four kids, and Michael has five kids. So we have nine grandkids. Yeah, so we have five boys and four girls. So now my wife, Dee Dee, and I are at the stage of getting our folding chairs and watching everything from soccer to basketball to flag football. Now we're watching tackle football this year. Lacrosse, taekwondo. So we made sure to get very comfortable chairs. So they're both doing extremely well, and we're thankful. And so, yeah, they were born my second year and third year in the league.
Interesting. So. That's great. And that amazing that they were such great athletes, too. I guess that comes from the family, I suppose.
Well, I thank my wife for the, we both, I think, added to the athleticism, and I thank her for the academia that they both experienced. So I helped a little bit, but Michelle got her undergrad in clothing and merchandise. And after about a year in the clothing business, she said, "I think I want to work with kids." So she interned at a monastery that she graduated from in Mason while getting her master's in education at Xavier, and taught school for a few years before she started a family. Then I shared with Michael, he was finished his undergrad in 3 years, was halfway through one master's at Tennessee, then left. And when he was drafted, he went to Miami and got his MBA. And so, yeah, they both have done extremely well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, and with your college background, your NFL background, it's fantastic. You retired after 13 years. You really could have done anything you wanted. Could have gone fishing. You could have, but – you decided to do something different. And we want to talk a little about kind of what happened after you retired.
Yeah, I retired. And really, at the end of my career, I contemplated, do I go into coaching or do I go into broadcasting? One of the things that I enjoyed, I had an opportunity my last 7 years when I was playing with the Bengals. I did high school radio here locally, which, as you know, high school football is amazing.
Yeah.
So for 7 years, I worked with a gentleman, and I did high school football on radio, which was a lot of blast. I mean, there's some tough times because late in the season, you might get to a stadium and there's no room in the press box. Mm-hmm. So you get the top row of the bleachers and you have to hold your papers down with the rock because it's 35 degrees. But it was fun. And so when I retired, I looked into coaching and then I looked into broadcasting and I thought about it. And I said, you know what? My kids are 9 and 11. If I get into coaching, which I love doing, I really wanted to do that, but you won't see your kids a whole lot.
Yeah.
You got to put, and it's long hours. So I went into broadcasting. I did 7 years of broadcasting. I worked with Fox. When I retired, they got the NFL. So I got hired by Fox. And then I went to ESPN. And so I did that for six, seven years. And then when the kids were going off to college, I left broadcasting because I knew if I was broadcasting on the weekend, I wouldn't be able to watch Michael play. And I wanted to watch him play at the University of Tennessee. Right when they started college, I started thinking about, okay, what am I going to do when they finish school? Because it's only going to be 4 years and I'm going to have a lot of time. And what am I going to do? I mean, I enjoy playing golf, but I'm not going to play golf 7 days a week. So I started thinking about foundation when I retired, but I didn't want to do it because when I do something, I want to be able to be totally engaged. Just like I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it when I was playing because as a husband, as a father, playing football, I didn't see any time to be engaged in the foundation. And I understand the leverage and the relevance of being an NFL football player and how that helps. But I wanted to be there. I started to think about it. I had some good friends who were, you know, CEOs of companies and say, hey, when are we going to do something together? And I started putting together my mission statement and exactly what I wanted to do. So it was 2002 when I decided to, I was gone from broadcasting. I was still watching the kids. I said, you know, they have a couple years of college left. Let's start the foundation now. And that was, we're going on 19 years now that we started the foundation.
Wow.
And have some great, great corporate partners. In fact, I still laugh about it because we do a lot with Cincinnati Bell. You guys are great to be one of our, I'm going to say the first, one of the first partners because at the time, Jack Cassidy was the CEO of Cincinnati Bell. And we kept talking about doing something together. So when I put my mission statement together, and he was the first guy, I said, okay, now we can do something together. And Cincinnati Bell was one of the very first partners. And here we are 19 years later, still working together. So I started the foundation. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, as naive as I was, I thought, okay, I'm going to put a foundation together. And that's going to allow me just to put all my time into my foundation. And I can, you know, really appreciate what everybody else is doing in the non-for-profit world. But now I have I still do a lot of other stuff outside of my foundation, which is great. And I'm thankful I have that opportunity. But so the foundation and then a couple other small companies, you know, I mentioned the agency that Michael and I started, that's still going strong with doing fan development, Hispanic outreach for the NFL. I have a corporate apparel company, corporate apparel promotional item company. I'm learning a lot, still learning a lot. You know, I've been out of the league 27 years and, you know, those 13 years that I had playing, you know, I tell people my classmates at SC had 13 years of business experience to jump on me. So I had to, you know, I've been excited learning about the non-for-profit world. I've engaged. My name's on it, so I'm there all the time. And the other two for-profit companies, I'm learning about it. It's been exciting for me to really learn a lot of different things. And I've always been one that enjoys doing a lot of different things. I know when I was playing football, it was just football, football, football. So when I retired, it gave me an opportunity to really expand myself and learn some different things.
Yeah. Well, the foundation is an organization we've been working with for some time now, which has been fantastic. Can you talk a little about what the foundation does and kind of what the activities are, the priorities?
Yeah, we have, it's interesting because when we first started the foundation, we had, I think, three programs, and then we allocated money to different groups that I'd been working with. And then we went into it about year five, and we said, you know, it doesn't make sense for a company to give us money and then us give another non-for-profit money. So we kind of changed our mission statement. So we have like seven programs now. So we run all our programs. We don't allocate any funds. We use the funds for the kids now. We start out, we do a mentoring program over at the Padilla Roberts Academy that goes K-3. We've kind of focused on K-3 because once you reach that third grade, if you're not reading at a certain, they say statistically, you know, you're less to graduate high school. So we really focus on that. Then in addition to the kids that age out of that, we have our Unplugged program, which we really call, you know, high school readiness and character. And we get a chance. We brought the kids here to Cincinnati Bell to see what goes on in, you know, corporate America. We've taken them to NKU to see, you know, what it looks like after high school to go to college. So that's our mentoring program and our Unplugged. We have what we call character camps. And people think, well, you played football, so they're football camps. No, they're not 100% football camps. They're about a third football, a third team building, a third character. We have two overnight camps, and up at Camp Chautauqua up in Franklin, we try to get 150 young men from age 11 to 13, 14. And one of them is a pretty diverse we have in the spring. We have kids from, you know, Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky, Dayton, Hamilton. We just try to get them from everywhere. And then we have another one, same type of camp, is in the fall, and that's 100% Hispanic kids. And we get them from a lot of the same areas. So we have those two. And then we have what we call our youth leadership seminar, which is coming up here this next week, where it's a full day of motivational leadership speakers. We have breakout sessions. We really try to kind of, you know, communicate and talk to the young people. I think right now we have 80 high schools registered, over 1,000 young men and women. And then at the end of the day, we give them a charge and they put together community service projects. And we have our community service challenge. And we track them. I pick a couple winners, give them some money to use towards their projects. And a lot of these projects have been sustainable over the years, which is pretty exciting. And these high school kids put them together. The moderators that bring them to the leadership seminar are there. But the high school students will put these together. And then we have our dinner and our golf, our Cincinnati Bell charity golf tournament in the summer. But after that, we have another camp. And it's basically the same template as the overnight camps. But it's we kind of went down to 2 days. It had been 3 days, but it's a two-day camp. And this year, we collaborated with the Bengals, did it at Paul Brown Stadium. And we had over 400 young people.
Wow.
And about 20-25% of those kids are young ladies. Hmm. It's the same thing. We teach them a little football, but it's character and team building. And then we have two different types of scholarships. We have our straight-A scholarship, which we hold at Jeff Ruby's every year. This past April, we just had our 18th straight-A luncheon. And Jeff Ruby is amazing, gives us the restaurant totally comp from 11 to about 2. We have 9 male and 9 female finalists. Straight-A's, encompassing the A's, athletics, academics, attitude, achievement. But a big criteria is overcoming adversity.
Yep.
And we have 9 male, 9 female. They bring their most influential teachers. We have about 130 people at the restaurant to honor these young men and women and some of the adversity that they have overcome. And they're excelling. I mean, these kids, I should call them young men and women, are excelling academics, athletics, community service hours. And they might be homeless. Mom might be a heroin addict. Dad's in prison.
Wow.
They might be living with grandma and grandpa. But it doesn't matter to them. That, you know, this is their way out. And then, mm-hmm. So it's a one-time scholarship, $2,000 to $5,000 one-time scholarship. And then at our dinner in the summer, we have the Anthony Munoz Scholarship Fund. And depending on budget, we give out anywhere from $4,000 to $20,000 scholarships. And one of the exciting things we're doing now is we're really working hard to get partners to attach, to really give the scholarship and then attach their name to it. We've started a relationship with NKU. We started with Mercy Health. Actually have a former, and I hate to bring this team up, but he's been phenomenal. He's actually given a $20,000 scholarship, and that's Franco Harris of the Pittsburgh Steelers.
I mean, yeah. That's right. No
there's
kidding.
Some good Steelers out
wow.
there.
Yeah.
Just leave it on the field. Leave yeah. it on the field.
But I've had a long-term relationship with Franco. He's come to my dinner a long time ago, and this past April we're together at an event. So he's asking me how the foundation is doing, and he says, count me in for a scholarship. So I'm trying to do that. We have some meetings set up with a couple more universities here. 2 years ago, we were able to give one of our young ladies a $113,000 full tuition scholarship
wow.
to Thomas Moore.
That's great.
So, you know, those are the things that just motivate me and keep me incentivized to keep the foundation going.
So you talked about your camps and the representation, right? And I think, kind of think about Conexión and kind of what that means from a representation standpoint. When I got personally excited when you did, you were on that Modelo commercial. I loved seeing kind of the diversity of background that Modelo was kind of reaching for. And obviously it was exciting seeing you since we all get like hometown pride and all that stuff. What does it mean when somebody approaches you and asks you to do a commercial or an event or something like that, knowing that there are going to be young Hispanic kids looking up to you and saying, I can do that. I can be a football player or I can be a firefighter. I can be a pilot.
Right.
Like those are very, to me, it's very significant. And you know, I'm not from a Hispanic background, so I kind of would like to know how that feels for you.
Well, anytime I'm asked and young people are involved in receiving the message, I get excited. I think back to, I shared my background and the people that were involved with my life and assisted me and mentored me. And so having accomplished what I have, I think it's a great opportunity You mentioned the Modelo commercial. I mean, at first it was like a beer commercial. Then they sent me the message. They sent me the previous commercials they made with the retired astronaut and the retired female fighter pilot. And I'm thinking, I know it's a beer commercial, but this message is unbelievable.
It's so much more.
It says, you know, regardless of where you're from, that you can accomplish things.
And,
And that's what's so great about our Hispanic character camp is we've had speakers come in that look like these kids do that are working at Cincinnati Bell, that are, you know, in college or working, you know, or an orthopedic surgeon as we did last. And they're like, wow, they look like me. They can accomplish things. And so that's why I did the Modelo commercial, because of their fighting spirit tagline and the fact that they were showing where I was from and what I've been able to accomplish, along with two younger guys, Tony Gonzalez and Roberto Garza, who said, well, when I was coming up, here's a old guy that I were looking up with. It's okay. I don't mind. That, you know, kind of blazed the trail. And that's, I guess, what we're, you know, excites me anytime I get an opportunity, not only as someone that has been successful in NFL, but as a Hispanic that played in the NFL, where when I was coming in, there weren't a whole lot of Hispanics playing. There was several, but they were all kickers, you know.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the Cincinnati Bengals for 10 years had two Hispanics playing on the offensive line with me and Max Montoya. So, you know, I take it seriously. I take being a role model seriously, and especially with my Hispanic background, is saying to the Hispanic kids, you know, you might not think that you can play football at a high level, but you can. There's a lot of us that are doing it and have done it.
So impactful. And I'm hoping that, you know, when we bring these tour groups of students through Bell, and I'm hoping that they see Conexión as kind of like a conduit for, you know what, when I grow up, I can work in technology, right? Yeah. Because that's something that we struggle with, and we're very open about it. We want to improve our diversity of employees.
Right.
And, I mean, if you look at our numbers, our Hispanic employees, it's probably one of the smallest.
I mean,
it's less than 5%, which is very, very tiny and not representative of Cincinnati even at all. So I'm kind of hoping that, you know, kids can see us and say, I want to break into this technology space. And I think that's where the representation is so, so key. And
yeah, we love
that commercial anyway. But
and that's what I appreciate about, you know, our staff being able to bring our own plug kids here to Cincinnati Bell.
Yeah.
And really seeing beyond high school.
Yes.
Beyond college even, you know.
Yes.
And maybe college isn't for everyone. Maybe a trade school, or maybe, you know, doing, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's value. You know, there's value there.
And these kids have parents that might have jobs like laborers or that don't really have, they can't really talk to their kids about what it's like to work in an office or what it's like to have this kind of a job. So having them here is fantastic for that. So Anthony, this has been fantastic. You know, we didn't even touch on your Hall of Fame election, first ballot Hall of Famer. I mean, there's so many other things we could have talked about, but I think what I've walked away with today is really going back to your origin story and going back to the values that your mom gave you and how that really shaped you as a person for the rest of your life. And you're still living it today. And what you've done for the community has been incredible. And we're all very proud to be Hispanics, to be alongside of you. So thank you for everything you've done.
Well, I appreciate that. And like we talked about earlier, the journey is so much more important than when you finally accomplish something. And I think just to quote our president at the Hall of Fame, when we're out, he says, not everybody can be a Pro Football Hall of Famer, but what we're doing using the platform is trying to make Hall of Fame people. And I think with what my mom taught us and what we all have an opportunity to do with young people in our community is hopefully teach them the values that got us to where we are so they can become Hall of Fame people.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you.
As always, thanks for listening to the Chats That Matter podcast. This episode was hosted by Annette DiTomaso. That's me. With editing and production by Matt Mulcahy. Special thanks to our guest, Anthony Munoz. If you have any questions or comments, please send us an email at ctmpodcast@simbell.com.